Hello there, ladies and gentlemen. I want to welcome you to our rockin' Progressive News Network. We've got a real fine show for you tonight. Some wonderful guests. Shauna Vercher, running for the Florida House. We've got Luis Cuevas of Progressive Push. Steve Horn of Dismog Blog, HuffPost, and Fire Dog Lake. And also Tony Knoll of the New Progressive Alliance. Wonderful guests, and now the news. This shout-out to President Obama and Secretary Vilsack, kill the 50 filthy chicken rule. They're trying to change the rule so that the chicken inspections are sped up, and of course they'll be inspected by the people who are delivering them and selling them, up to 175 chickens per minute. You can't hardly even count 175 chickens per minute. So to pretend that there's going to be some kind of inspection going on with 175 chickens per minute is frankly absurd. So contact Secretary Vilsack and the president and say, you can't eliminate government inspectors. You can't replace them with chicken company employees. And you absolutely can't inspect 175 chickens per minute. It's an insult to the intelligence of the American voter. Next up, hey, Pulitzer Prizes for reporting on whistleblower Snowden's news, but nothing but threats and charges against Mr. Snowden himself. Something odd there, you know, something very odd. On Monday, April 14th, the Washington Post and the Guardian U.S. newspapers received the Pulitzer Prize for Journalism's Public Service for their reports on NSA spying. In light of their hard work, let's recap the events of the last year. Embarrassed and irritated by Edward Snowden's leaks, Obama charged last year at a press conference that Snowden was presenting a false picture of the NSA by releasing parts of its work piecemeal. America is not interested in spying on ordinary people, he assured us. The government is not listening to people's phone calls or inappropriately reading people's emails. 6 days later, Washington Post headline declared, NSA broke privacy rules thousands and thousands of times per year. In an internal audit made 2012 of its D.C. area spy centers, the agency itself found 2,776, quote, incidences of NSA overstepping its legal authority. Now, when you overstep legal authority, that sounds like breaking law. Oh yeah, but it's them, so, yeah, they don't, you know, break laws, I guess. ACLU adds that these reported incidents are not simply cases of one person's rights being violated, but thousands of Americans' rights being snared totally without clause in the NSA's indiscriminate computer-driven dragnet. The agency's surveillance net stretches so wide that it's inherently abusive, even though its legal authority to spy on Americans is quite limited. Oh, you mean, yeah, you know, by law. U.S. Representative James Sensenbrenner, sponsor of the Patriot Act, which NSA cites as its super authority, said that Congress intended it should only apply to cases directly tied to national security investigations. No lawmaker, he said, meant that government snoops should be able to conduct a wholesale grab of Americans' phones, email, and other personal records, and then store them in huge databases to be searched at will. Oh, you remember that pesky Fourth Amendment? Oh, yeah. Okay, let's look at what NSA has become. 3 billion phone calls made in the U.S. each day are snatched up by the agency, which stores each call's metadata, phone numbers, the parties, date and time, length of call, etc., for 5 years. Each day, telecom giants turn over metadata on every call they've processed. Oh, that's every call. Every call. Every out-of-country call, and email to and from a U.S. citizen is grabbed by NSA computers, and agents are authorized to listen or read, you know, any of them. The agency searches for and seizes nearly everything we do on the Internet without bothering to the constitutional niceties of obtaining a warrant. Its X Keyscore program scoops up some 40 billion Internet records every month and adds them to its digital storehouse, including our emails, Google searches, websites visited, Microsoft Word documents sent. The NSA's annual budget includes $250 million for corporate partner access. Hey, Snowden says that in his days as an analyst, he could sit at his computer and tap into any American's internet activity, even the president's. Okay, next story. Oh, by the way, don't forget, you can always get the further details of these news stories by going to averyvoice.com. That's A-V-E-R-Y, voice, averyvoice.com. That's where you can get the full text and links of all the news stories that we do and some of them that we don't get to. Okay, next story. U.S. ground troops are going to Poland. Defense Minister says 18 April 2014, Poland and the U.S. will announce next week deployment of U.S. ground forces to Poland as part of an expansion of NATO's presence in Central and Eastern Europe in response to events in the Ukraine. Oh, did we say gas resources in the Ukraine? Oh, I mean, our commitment to democracy. You know, they hate us for our TV commercials. I mean, they hate us for our, no, they hate us for our, I forget what they hate us for. Anyway, I'm sure it's our freedom. Okay, number four, U.S. plans ground force exercises in Eastern Europe. You know, because if Russia and China were doing exercises in Canada and Mexico, we'd have no problem with that, right? Now, another question, this one for Floridians, asking for a debate, an unreasonable request? Well, then I'm going to be unreasonable. Like the factory worker who demanded a safety net after the Triangle Shirt Factory, I'm unreasonable. Like the radicals who oppose children in factories, I'm unreasonable. Like the workers who struck and earned an 8-hour day and a 40-hour week, who earned all the lazy go-along, get-along weekends and paid vacations, I'm unreasonable enough to demand, again, clean water and healthy air. And if fighting to keep money out of politics and Monsanto off the Supreme Court and the FDA, count on me to be unreasonable. Because I remember the promises of candidates who was going to march with Union brothers and sisters, who was going to make sure that instead of rebuilding Afghanistan and Iraq, we were going to rebuild America. I was in Denver. I heard the promise of universal health care right after the election. And after that, and after I wiped the happy tears from my eyes, I saw exactly who it was we'd elected. So yeah, I'm unreasonable. Call it my stress position. And Eric Holder can celebrate it. Him and the boys from Wall Street who got the I'm above the law badges and decoder rings. Biden in Ukraine. Tom Horn's going to be talking about that a little bit. Excuse me, Steve. Steve Horn's going to be talking about that. Biden in Ukraine. We recognize no sphere of influence, Biden said, or no ability of any other nation to veto the choices an independent nation makes as to whom and under what circumstances they will associate. We also do not believe in zero-sum thinking. We do not believe, he said, that a partnership with one nation must come at the expense of another. It has not, it does not, and it will not. He also said, referencing the Munich Security Conference just weeks after taking office, it holds true. I want to reemphasize it. We reject the notion of spheres of influence as 19th century ideas that have no place in the 21st century. And we stand by the principles that sovereign states have a right to make their own decisions, to chart their own foreign policy, to choose their own alliances. I guess he forgot about Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya. Oh, you know, the usual suspects. Oh, did I forget to mention Pakistan? And, of course, Ukraine, I crane, we all crane for Ukraine. President Obama, in a speech in Moscow 2 weeks ago, strongly affirmed this principle. He said, and I quote, the state sovereignty must be the cornerstone of international order. I guess they forgot about invasions of, you know, Iraq without a, you know, declaration of war and such. Net neutrality away! That, in a nutshell, is this Federal Communication Commission's last response in a bombshell court decision in January that blew apart its rules on net neutrality. The principle that internet service providers can't favor one type of traffic over another when they connect consumers to the internet. Imagine this. The powers that be, the mainstream media, can put down a dime every time they want to send you a message. But local progressive broadcasters, broadcasters who aren't with mainstream media, they can't put a dime down every time they want to send you a message. So guess what? Guess who gets frozen out? All the small fry, all the non-mainstream media. We all will get reduced to the internet back roads. That's what net neutrality means. And if you don't know about it, look it up, my friends, look it up. According to the Wall Street Journal, proposed rules the FCC will announce on Thursday will bar ISPs from discriminating against certain websites, but it will allow content companies to pay the internet service providers for, quote, special access to consumers. In plain English, that means that an ISP like Comcast can't slow down traffic from Netflix, but it could cut a deal with one of Netflix's competitors to make that competition's traffic go much faster. Sounds like a strange definition of net neutrality. You're right. An ISP that gives faster treatment to some sites is no more neutral than one that slows down other sites. The measure comes after FCC Chairman Tom Wheeler said in February that the agency would not allow blocking or discrimination. But he didn't say it wouldn't allow speed up. FCC is now reportedly trying to maintain a semblance of neutrality by requiring the ISPs who offer a sweetheart traffic deal to one company must offer the same deal to others on a commercially reasonable terms. That's like that old saying that goes, you know, rich and poor alike are able to sleep under the bridge. Yep, that's right. Okay, next story. Net neutrality can be saved, but only if citizens raise an outcry. This is from a story by John Nichols in The Nation. When Barack Obama was running for president in 2007, he earned a great deal of credibility with tech-savvy voters by expressing support for net neutrality, rooted in an understanding that the issues raised essential questions about the future of open, free, and democratic communications. Obama got it that net neutrality represented an internet age equivalent of the First Amendment, a guarantee of equal treatment for all content, as opposed to special rights to speed and quality of service for a powerful few that can afford to buy an advantage. Asked whether he thought the FCC and Congress needed to preserve the internet as we know it, the senator from Illinois said, "The answer is yes. I'm a strong supporter of net neutrality." That was then. This is now. What you've been seeing is some lobbying that says the servers and various portals through which you're getting your information over the internet should be able to be gatekeepers and charge different rates to different websites, explained Obama, who warned that with such a change of standards, you could get much better quality from the Fox site than you'd be getting rotten service from mom-and-pop sites. Look it up. The freedom of information on the web depends on net neutrality. Okay, next story. Representative Mark Pafford, House Democratic leader designate West Palm Beach, said the legislative leadership has devoted extensive hearings to overhauling the Florida retirement system. Conflicting bills in the House and Senate are likely to be compromised in the closing days of the session. Democrats have insisted that the FRS is in no trouble. The GOP leaders are just trying to get the state out of the pension business by moving new employees to a market-based investment plan. There is no issue, said Pafford. This is another example of something the Republican leadership has offered as a major issue. It's pretty sad when politics is put over policy. Yes, indeed. Oh, by the way, dog lovers are leading Miami-Dade County. A few might be aware that the county's human services budget, social services, was severely impacted since 2008. The county has cut tens of million dollars of library funding. The mayor wanted to close half the libraries. He wanted to impose park entrance fees. Yet, due to these cuts, people have donated more to the county animal trust than to parks, social services, and libraries combined. People with money favor dogs over humans. That news was sent to us by the Honorable Tufik Zakaria, MPA, Miami-Dade County Community Councilman, District 10, Florida Advisory Committee member for the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, and president and co-founder of MEPA, co-founder of the Near East Peace Project. He also mentions that in another story that a prime example of this kind of odd reasoning and odd commitment is UM President Donna Shalala. She wrote an article for the Miami Herald in support of the Miami-Dade pet trust idea, but she never, ever supported any political idea in the county. She said, "We must support our four-legged friends, etc. I love my doggie." She never wrote the Herald to say they needed maintained funding for the 49 libraries. However, for the Pet Trust, it's a different story. Thanks, Tufik. You're a hero, buddy. About 15,000 years ago, the world's first farmer had an idea of saving the seeds from one year's crop and planting them again next year. That's how farmers have worked for thousands of years, until Monsanto. But now, ladies and gentlemen, it's time for our first segment from our good friends at SEIU. They're going to give us the Tallahassee Report. Here we go. SEIU from the Tallahassee Report. And today we've got our special guest from SEIU, Miss Rebecca Wakefield, and also Isabel Sousa Rodriguez, who are going to give us the Tallahassee update. Welcome, Rebecca. Welcome, Isabel.
Hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Very good, very good. Want to welcome
Great
you both
to be here.
And ask you to fill us in on the latest shenanigans of those bozos up in Tallahassee. our representatives.
I'll give you a basic update, and then Isabel is going to talk more about some of the things that FLIC has been involved in the past few weeks.
Sounds good.
So right now in Tallahassee, we're in the last 2 weeks of the session, which is where things really start to get interesting because, you know, as the time gets closer, the leadership really starts negotiating on the major issues between the House and the Senate. So you have a number of things that are happening. Actually, as we're recording this on a Friday, the House just passed its sweeping overhaul of the pension system, and it is obviously not something that we support. It's basically trying to shift people into 401k-style investment plans if they don't know enough to go for their defined benefit plans, and also extends the vesting period to qualify for pensions from 8 years to 10 years. That went through. They had piggybacked it on a local pension bill, and so it went through the House today. But it's going to go to the Senate, and it's going to have a much more challenging time in the Senate. They're a little bit more skeptical about major overhauls to the pension system, so we're going to attempt to hold them to that perspective. Another issue that was hot in Tallahassee is there's this huge bill called that people are calling the Trauma Train Bill because it was initially a bill that was just for the dealing with trauma centers essentially in Central Florida, but because that was going to go through, a whole bunch of other stuff got tacked onto it, like telemedicine. And for us in Miami, an unfortunate amendment got tacked on there that was aimed directly at our public hospital system down here to essentially take the power of the county commission to negotiate labor contracts at the hospital away from them and give it to the public health trust, which is an appointed board, not an elected board. We are fighting that tooth and nail. And in fact, a friendly representative tried to put an amendment on today to take that part out. But unfortunately, some of the Miami-Dade Republicans didn't support that, so it didn't get taken off the House version. It's now going to go to the Senate, and we're reasonably confident the Senate is not going to pass that, but obviously we'll be fighting that in the next week to make sure that that doesn't happen. It's really a direct anti-labor slap in the face to all the employees that work in the public hospital system down here. On the positive side, there was another issue for Jackson, the public hospital, and a lot of other public hospitals around the state. The state was changing how Medicaid payments were going to be structured and changing who was going to get the money, and essentially it was moving this huge pot of federal money from the safety net hospitals and distributing it more widely to hospitals around the state. But it is a huge disadvantage to counties that where the public taxes themselves to support their hospital systems. And there's matching federal dollars. So by doing this tiering system, it was really taking money away from the public system and giving it more to private hospitals, which is really bad. And in the case of Jackson, they stood to lose something like $140 million. So the legislature has fix that at least for a year. They're not going to implement tiering until 2015. So we have another year to work on that and try to make that system more equitable. Let's see. There was also...
weren't they also trying to change when abortions would be available?
Yes. They, in fact, the Senate is supposed to vote today on a proposal to restrict abortions after the fetus is determined viable, which has passed the House and Senate today, today being Friday. It's going to be working on that, and I don't know if at this moment they have passed that or not, but we're certainly against that. Then really I'd like to turn it over to Isabel to talk about the in-state tuition rates for undocumented students. That's an issue that's had a lot of ups and downs, and I know a lot of students flooded the Capitol recently. And, you know, introduce yourself, tell us about yourself, and then, you know, kind of what's been going on the last week.
Welcome, Isabel.
Hi, everyone. I'm a community organizer with the Florida Immigrant Coalition. I emerged out of the Dreamer movement, undocumented youth who were brought to this country at a young age. I got involved in 2007 with the coalition and eventually was sponsored by my stepmother, and that's really the only way I was able to stay in the country. But we know that every year 65,000 students graduate from high schools without their status, and that means that when they get to the college level, their tuition rates are 3 or 4 times higher, which becomes very prohibitive for their academic aspirations, their career goals. Many of the students that we work with throughout the state of Florida can only afford to take 1 or 2 classes at a time, with jobs on the side trying to save up to continue their education, you know, but then it ends up taking them 7, 8 years to get a 4-year degree. So this issue has been around since 2001. In 2001, the Federal DREAM Act was filed, and states started taking up legislation at a local level to try to address the tuition disparities. So here in Florida, for over a decade, the bill has been filed every year, and there's so much promise for this year because it passed the House of Representatives, it passed 3 committees in the Senate, which, you know, it really only needs a minimum of 1 before it can get a final vote. And really the only thing standing in the way of this legislation is President Gates. There are 40 members of the Senate. The bill has 21 co-sponsors. So just with its co-sponsors, it already has a majority vote in the Senate. But Senator Gates, he's opposed to this legislation. He said in February that even though he personally was going to be voting against it, that he was going to allow it to be debated on the Senate floor. He has not stayed true to that promise. He has yet to schedule it. So we have 40 students in Tallahassee right now. There's going to be between 50 to 100 students every day of next week in Tallahassee. They've launched what they call Dream University, where they have an occupation in front of the Senate chamber doors. And they do educational lessons where students, professors from local universities come and do lessons there in front of the chambers. And really, we need folks to get calls into Senator Gates' office. We need him to hold to his word that he's going to allow for there to be a debate next week. And it's going to be the last week of the session because he's really the only thing standing in the way. So. His number is 850-487-5001, and in any ways that people can put pressure on him, this is our last chance to make it happen.
Excellent.
Great. Thank you so much. That was really great. Is there a website or anything that people should, you know, if they want to share on Facebook or get more information?
Yeah. I mean, there is information available on the FloridaImmigrant.org. We have a petition set up that if you click on the petition, it actually sends a direct email to Senator Gates. So yeah, we encourage people to do that.
Great. We'll definitely be with you either in body or in spirit, and certainly online and on the phone. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you both.
Cool.
Rebecca, anything final you want to say today?
I think that's it. I think we're just going to try to get through this next week without any major damage to the people of Florida.
That'd be nice.
Being inflicted. So.
Well, thanks again. Thanks to all the good people from SEIU. And good luck on the education bill.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. Take care.
Care.
That was our good friends from SEIU giving us the Tallahassee report. We got time for a little bit more news before our first guest comes on. You know, many of us were told that, hey, we're pulling out of the Middle East. We're pulling out of Iraq. We're going to be down to just a few people. And you know, we're out of Afghanistan, and we're certainly not, sending drones over Pakistan or Yemen anymore because, you know, I mean, we're out of that. And yet there's this story. As Iraqi violence grows, U.S. sends more intelligence officers. That'd be nice. The U.S. is quietly expanding the number of intelligence officers in Iraq and holding urgent meetings in Washington and Baghdad to find ways to counter growing violence by Islamic militants. This from Reuters. A high-level Pentagon team is now in Iraq to assess possible assistance for Iraqi forces in their fight against radical jihadists from the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, ISIL, a group reconstituted from an earlier incarnation of Al-Qaeda. Evidently, they believe in reincarnation. Said two government officials and one former official familiar with the matter. The powerful ISIL, which seeks to impose strict Sharia law in the Sunni-majority populated regions of Iraq, now boasts territorial influence stretching from Iraq's western Anbar province to northern Syria, operating in some areas close to Baghdad, said U.S. officials. Senior U.S. policy officials known as the Deputies Committee met in Washington this week to discuss possible responses to the deteriorating security outlook in Iraq. Don't worry, though, we're done with fighting in Iraq. I'm sure they'll assure us of that any day now. White House spokeswoman Bernadette Meehan declined to comment because, well, you know, this is an open and transparent administration. Meetings underscore how Iraq's instability is posing new foreign policy challenges for President Barack Obama, who celebrated the withdrawal of U.S. troops more than 2 years ago, not with an ironic sign saying, "Mission still accomplished." Despite the concern, officials said it remains unclear whether Obama will commit significant new resources. Instead, they're just going to send a sprinkling of intelligence officers, read CIA. Or maybe, you know, mercenaries, whichever, you know, works easier for them. 4 months after Iraq Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki declared war on Sunni militants in Iraq's western Anbar province, the fighting has descended into brutal atrocities, often caught on video and in photographs by both militants and Iraqi soldiers. Yeah, their Facebook is really... Iraqi soldiers say they're bogged down in a slow and vicious fight with ISIL and other Sunni factions in the city of Ramadi and around nearby Fallujah. I didn't even say radioactive Fallujah, did I? Limited options. One former and two current U.S. security officers say the number of intelligence personnel in Baghdad has begun to rise, but that number remains relatively small. It's really, you know, really pretty small, right, relatively. It's more than before, but not really a lot. It's bigger than a bread box, smaller than a, you know, tank. It's unarmored like a Humvee, and it's not quite secure like, well, you know, a military base in Texas. So after ending nearly 9 years of war in Iraq, the U.S. has limited military options inside the country. Of course, you know, gosh, we couldn't send in, you know, militia or anything. About 100 U.S. military personnel remain. yeah, okay, sure, we'll believe that. Okay, next story, secret public pension deals. I know you'll love this because, you know, of course, Florida legislature is trying to make sure that we gut our official state pension programs in favor of, you know, kind of public-private partnerships, man. And here's a story about those public-private partnerships. In the national debate over what to do about public pension shortfalls, there's something you may not know. Ha! The text of the agreement signed between those pension funds and the financial firms are almost always secret. Say that again with me. Almost always secret. Yes, that's right. Yes, that's right. Although they are public pensions that taxpayers contributed to, that public officials oversee, the exact terms of the financial deals being engineered in the public's name and with public money are typically not available to you and me, the taxpayer. To understand why this should be a cause for concern, ponder some possibilities as they relate to pension deals, private equity partnerships, and so-called alternative investments. For example, it's possible that secret terms of such agreements could allow other private individuals in the same investments to negotiate preferential terms for themselves, meaning public employees' pension monies enriches those private investors. It's also possible that the secret terms of the agreement create the heads Wall Street wins, tails pensioners lose, whereby retirees' money is subjected to huge risks, yet financial firms' profits are guaranteed. And before you claim this is a minor problem, consider some numbers. According to Seidel's report, the huge pension system now is authorized to invest up to 35% or $30 billion of its assets in alternatives. Consider, too, that Seidel's report shows that with such a huge allocation of these risky of alternatives, the fund has underperformed the average public plan by $6.8 billion. And finally, fees have skyrocketed over 1,000% since 2000 and have almost doubled since 2008. From $217 million to $416 million. Oh, yeah, that's profits for them. He writes, adding the annual fees and expenses will amount to approximately $1 billion in the near future. And now, ladies and gentlemen, without any further ado, let me bring on candidate Shauna Vercher. Shauna, welcome.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Oh, it's our pleasure. It's we only invite candidates on who are progressive activists first. And that's why you're here. I want to welcome you, and I want to wish your campaign every success. So, Shauna, why don't you tell us about some of the issues that you're focused on as a progressive activist campaigner?
Well, as you know, and some of your listeners and the people that I've seen around the progressive community are familiar with, I've been involved in politics from a bit different perspective for years. I was a consulting advisor for a number of different high-profile candidates. I worked on the Obama for President campaign. I became a media correspondent for Huffington Post and for ARN and ABC and CBS. And so for years, I have been basically telling the story of families that have been hurting. And recently, it became painfully obvious that for me to really achieve the goals that I feel that progressives have right now, that they needed someone with, you know, quite frankly, a big mouth to get out there and advocate for them in Tallahassee. So my first and foremost goal is for families in Florida of all shapes, colors, and sizes to feel heard. And beyond that, the specific issues that they're telling me they're concerned about are not really surprising. Making sure we have more high-paying jobs in Florida, making sure that the kids have access to school systems that are competitive and safe, bringing more high-tech and green jobs to the state, making sure that our energy bills and different bills associated with flood insurance and home ownership stay reasonable and affordable. These are things that we've been screaming to the high heavens for a long time, but I'm hoping that as a candidate and ultimately hopefully as a legislator, I could bring a little bit more attention to them from a common sense perspective.
Oh, that's great. And I know you're very environmentally oriented also. Tell us some of the issues that are involved in the environment around the area that you're running for in the Clearwater area.
Well, Clearwater and Pinellas County specifically have a number of tourist destinations. We're no different from much of Florida in that regard. And while my district does not include the beaches, obviously that's something that we're extremely mindful of. I think Floridians had a little bit of a jolt when we had the oil spill, which feels like it's been a long time ago, but it really has not been that long ago that we had oil on our beaches. And so we want to be mindful to prevent that from happening as much as possible by getting more involved in that permitting regulation process of anyone that's doing anything off of our shores. The bigger, more immediate issue that a lot of people are facing in Pinellas County is we want to make sure to preserve and protect different parks that we have. That's a huge issue. We have a number of gorgeous parks, as you're familiar with, and we have a lot of dog parks and community-friendly areas. And that's one of the things that keeps our property values from going completely as far south as some of the others did when we had the economic dip, and it attracts families to move into the Pinellas County area. But because they are paid for in what we call a penny for Pinellas sales tax, then there's that temptation to rip that funding away and say, well, isn't this a luxury? And as someone who's lived in a number of different areas, one in particular in Texas outside of Refinery, where you didn't want your kids to play in a park even if you could find one that was safe, I can assure you that that's not just an environmental issue. This is an economic issue. And it's one of the things I'm hoping to paint a picture for people that are looking at that and saying, well, isn't this a luxury? Absolutely not. Environmentalism is something that keeps us from having a sales tax. It, because we have such high tourism, it causes tourists to spend money in our local businesses, and it continues to be a huge economic boom for us. So we as environmentalists need to not cede that ground and say, well, we'll get to that later after the real problems have been taken care of.
Let me ask you another difficult issue that faces Florida, especially given the power of the Republicans in Tallahassee. It seems there's increasing pressure to give away more Florida's educational resources to the private sector, whether it be applying to corporations to write our tests, to giving basically school money to have private corporations build school buildings and maintain them. What do you see as a what approach are you going to take to this privatization of schools?
Well, I think that the idea that people have is that businesses automatically run more efficiently, and I just find that to be a myth. I think that it's possible that a business could run more efficiently than a government in the fact of speed, but right now what I find is that that's not usually the case. The businesses that are that adaptable, that can move quickly, that can customize the needs, tend to be more of your entrepreneurs, and I can assure you that most entrepreneurs are not included in the equation when we're talking about privatization of any big government system. This is usually your bigger companies that by the time they can implement that software, it's practically outdated. I used to be a technology advisor under Governor Bush's administration, so I know firsthand how that bidding process works. I understand what has to go into, like you mentioning the testing software, what actually would make a good provider for that testing provider, and I can assure you that, unfortunately, that's not what's happening. We have a buddy system that's happening right now in Tallahassee where if someone's friends with a friend, they usually get preferential treatment in that bidding process. There's actually some pending legislation that was really quiet, and we're keeping an eye on it. I don't think it's going to pass, where there were certain types of contracts that wouldn't even have to go up for bid. And so the first thing is to bring that process out in the open. And for anything that's already been privatized, make sure it actually goes to someone competent and our dollars are being spent wisely. But the other thing is to get rid of that notion that private means that we're saving money. It's just not true. And first of all, our kids are not up for sale. We need to stop talking like they are. And the idea that we should be shoving our public tax dollars into private pockets of friends and friends of friends is something that has to be called out more. And we have to just stop allowing the conversation to happen as if it's fact that by doing this, it's the more fiscally responsible choice. It's absolutely not. And time again, we see that when we privatize systems, especially without good oversight, that it actually costs us more in the long run.
You know, there's been quite a few stories about whether it be climate change and the impact that's going to have on shorelines, impacts of fracking in Florida, drilling in the Everglades. And I realize you may not have those exactly in your area, but I'm sure these are issues of concern as well, because we're all dependent on the Florida aquifers for our water. Do you have any unique pressures on the water in the Pinellas County Clearwater area?
Well, I think we see it from the other side of things. We do have water restrictions regularly here in Pinellas County, but we know that that's a state issue. And, you know, we have sinkholes, which are, some are saying that that's a result of some of what's happening with the aquifers. What I would say is for people to keep in mind with any of their state legislatures, legislators that are running as candidates now, is that even though I happen to be a candidate in Pinellas County, if I were to be elected, I would be legislating laws that impact the entire state. And so it's important to kind of know enough to be dangerous with the different races that are happening around the state. Now, I know that sounds like a little bit overwhelming, but there are just a handful that are very competitive that have a big difference and a big impact on people across statewide. The environmental issues with water, I think that's something that is a house on fire, and we have a Tallahassee legislature that currently doesn't even want to acknowledge that it's smelling smoke. I actually had some special training through Leadership Florida on the potential of our water shortage crisis. It's very real, and this isn't something that is an environmental problem. This is every citizen here in the state's problem, potentially within the next 5 to 10 years. So one key to this is for people to be educated about it, and how I can help play a role is to talk about it even when it's not popular, try to get media interest in it in a really relatable way, even though we're not, even at the times when we're not in session, and to show that this isn't something that a quote-unquote tree hugger is the only one that needs, they need to be care about it. Now, I happen to be a tree hugger in many ways, but I'm also very pragmatic. And the bottom line is, if we continue the way that we are, we're going to have a real crisis, not just for families, but also for businesses. And that should be a problem for both Democrats and Republicans.
You know, it's been very interesting to see how the alternate energy is evolving across the states. Here, you know, there are many who would argue, myself included, that we're not taking full enough advantage of solar power. And we see the state of Oklahoma actually going so far as to put extra taxes on people who use solar power. I know we've had curious things here in Florida where the nuclear power companies have gotten money whether or not they were going to build, and I think that's being phased out, I understand. But what do you see as Florida's strengths and weaknesses in terms of alternate energy?
One of the biggest problems I think that we have is a lack of a cohesive voice that's actually sitting down with the people who can make this happen and actually seeing what could we bring to the table in the short term. You know, I recently sat down with Duke Energy and some people very high up in that organization to become educated on their perspective. And I got a little bit of backlash for that because people were like, oh, my gosh, that's the enemy, that's the enemy. No, that's the resource. Have they made some mistakes? Absolutely. Are they, you know, an organization that we need to keep an eye on? Of course. But if we're not talking to them, then nothing's going to get done. And one of the things that I was surprised to hear is when I asked people that are huge advocates for solar energy, is who is your connection in Tallahassee that's sitting down negotiating this? I couldn't get a name. Not one name. Now, I had people that were organizing protests. I had people that had given some speeches on it. But one of the things that I feel like we could benefit from as progressives is to take a page out of the playbook of conservatives and get a little bit more organized from a strategic perspective and hold our feet to the fire a little bit. You know, if they're willing, if an energy company is willing to invest in solar but maybe not reimburse each household as much for the solar that it generates, that's a temporary step forward. Is it everything that we want? No. But I can't even find anyone on our side to have a conversation like that. And so I'm hoping to be one of those voices at the table, but I would encourage people listening to look at the groups that you're already involved in and encourage them to communicate with other groups, because we pride ourselves on independence and creative thinking, and that's fantastic in so many ways. But until we become a cohesive collective voice, we're not going to really accomplish as much as I think we can in this state.
I think you make a very good point. And, you know, it's only in the last few years where I have seen a broader and broader coalition of progressive voices coming together to try to accomplish something more than just, you know, kind of angry shouting, if I could put a worse face on it. We all know there are many, many good people working whether it be on the water issue or on energy issues or alternative power or wildlife, what have you. But you're right. We have to have a strong front, a strong organized voice in Tallahassee. We may not have the resources of the Chamber of Commerce types, but within our own modest means, we need to do that sort of thing and have a consistent lobbying effort on these fronts. I think you make a very good point. And, you know, I think you made another important point when you said, you know, there were those who were critical of you because you spoke, quote, spoke to the enemy. You know, to draw an analogy, I listened to Mr. Netanyahu speaking and about how difficult it was to negotiate with somebody who he regarded as the enemy. And, you know, who is it that you're going to negotiate with? You have to negotiate with, quote, the enemy. With your friends, you have a chat. With your enemies, you have a negotiation. Well, of course you have to negotiate with the enemy. You can't stand there and talk to her only to yourself. So I think you make a very good point. I think it makes sense to engage the Duke Energies and the FPLs, regardless of what we feel about their motives and their ability to speak plainly and to the point.
Well,
we
and
have
I think
to
the
have
point
a dialogue.
Is to find the common ground. Right, absolutely. You have the dialogue and find the common ground so something can be moved forward. Now, in some cases, is there no common ground? Does it become a waste of energy? Absolutely. But I would say that we haven't exhausted that yet in a lot of different causes, not just environmentalism. And I think also, you know, I am more on the progressive side of things, though I am a pragmatist. I was a business owner for years. I have a business degree. So I tend to be more on that analytical side of things, but I'm still very passionate about our progressive issues. And I witness a lot of that passion around the state. However, what I find is when we do get emotional, and I am just as guilty of this as anyone else, and I'm trying really hard to work on it, is that we tend to say it's either this way or it's no way. You're either 100% with us or we're not with you. And so, you know, I found this. I worked on the Patrick Murphy race for Congress as an outside organization to defeat Alan West. And I sat down. I remember having a conversation with a progressive congressional organization and them saying, well, we were going to back Patrick, but I don't know if he's progressive enough. You're looking at Alan West, and there's even a question mark you're going to support. You know, I mean, this guy is he became the poster child for everything that was wrong with Congress. Hate speech, very intolerant of anyone that was different than him, stalling progress. That was Alan West. So I feel like Democrats also and progressives, and I would separate those two, but progressives specifically, I would love it if in this next election we say, listen, is it everything we wanted? No, but this is what we have, so let's use that as a foundation to build upon, and let's get behind some of these candidates and issues in a wholehearted way to make some progress rather than sit it out if it doesn't meet all of the specifications we have. I think the analogy for that is, you know, we're going into a home, and if it doesn't have walk-in closets, we'd rather sit outside in the dirt. You know, it's just not making much sense, and so yes, ultimately, we'd like to build that addition on the home. For now, let's get a roof over our head and make some good progress.
Well, I think in many cases, that's absolutely the best tactic. There are some issues, I think, that we have to make sure that the party understands that business as usual, Republicrats are not what the party should be supporting. But I think I can go most of the way along with you. You make some very good points. Let me ask you this. I know you've had some discussions in your campaign of some personal matters, some law enforcement things that have come up that you've had personal experience with. Do you want to talk about some of that?
I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to talk about it. I think that it's a subject that a lot of people shy away from, and I'm hoping that as a candidate that I can bring more attention to this very real issue. I was a business owner, as I mentioned before. I had a media and PR company for about 10 years that was doing really well, and I had a client who was my client for less than 4 months, and he became violent and became a stalker. And 4 years later, we're still dealing very publicly with that issue. And I talk about it extensively in a book that I wrote called A Fearless Voice. And I talk about my experience as a victim in our justice system and in our legal system and how frightening that was for me. And I consider myself to be an educated woman. I expected certain things to happen. I thought I had a realistic expectation of what happens when you call 911, what happens when you go try to get a restraining order. And I was shocked at what happened to me, and shocked and just absolutely heartbroken at some of the stories that I heard from other families I met along the way. And I did not know until recently that one out of every six women is a victim of stalking, to the point that they fear for their safety or the safety of a family member, one out of every 19 men. And so that's 25 million Americans that experience this. And what happens is we don't talk about it, for reasons of safety, for people that are prominent in the community or are career people or have a job. They may be worried that it will impact their job or people will think less of them. Maybe they think that their friends or neighbors will look down on them or think that they did something wrong or to ask for this type of behavior. And it's very frightening. And having worked in the area of domestic violence, and this was not a domestic situation, but it's very similar in a lot of different ways in the characteristics and the sociological profile of the aggressor. I can tell you that all too often these cases end in a violent, tragic end, and our law enforcement's hands are tied, essentially, from doing anything until the victim is actually hurt. So I am hoping that as a candidate I can shed some light on that issue, but from a bigger perspective, I'm hoping that I can become an advocate for improving our justice and our legal system. I am tired of Florida being in the headlines for the Casey Anthony situation and the Trayvon Martin situation, and we are known as a state that doesn't have an effective justice system or qualified law enforcement personnel. And I just don't think that that's telling the full story. And I also think that where those problems exist, they can be fixed. I don't think that we should cede that very important part of our democracy.
Obviously, this is a difficult thing to talk about, and you're doing a wonderful job communicating effectively about it. Do you believe there are law enforcement tools that need to evolve? Is it laws that need to be written? What are some of the things you think you've seen from this experience where you think things can be improved? Is it legislation needs to be done? Is it police training that needs to be taken into consideration? What do you think can be done?
I think that's a great question.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I think that's a fantastic question. I'm so glad. You're such a solutions-oriented person. That's one of the reasons I enjoy your program so much.
Thank you.
I think that one of the things that I learned, I spent 2.5 years researching this and talking to police officers and state attorney's officers and, the judges and people that were legislating. There's a couple of things. I do list about 10 core items in my book specifically that I would change if I could. But a couple of easy ones would be, first of all, legislation has not kept up with the technology specifically from a jurisdictional perspective. So I'll give you an example. If someone's on Facebook and sending you a horrible threatening message, but they're one county over, it is next to impossible to get one police station to stop passing the buck from a hot potato perspective of whose case that is. In my case, I had a situation that spanned 5 different jurisdictions. And at the end, Largo PD, who unfortunately had the hot potato land in their lap, said, yes, there were crimes committed, but we ultimately feel like it's not in our jurisdiction, so it's not our issue. And so we have to basically tighten up the laws where that's concerned and to keep up with the technology like Facebook and Twitter and email where people can be harassed from that perspective. So that's a legislative issue. It's also a resource issue for law enforcement, quite frankly. But the other thing is that's a simple thing that goes beyond the stalking issue and more into a broad issue for people that are trying to get help is that many victims from, victims of burglary to sexual assault to stalking to whatever the situation might be, they feel like they're re-victimized when they go into the police department. And I can tell you that I know a lot of amazing law enforcement officers, that's not their intention. And what I found the disconnect is that law enforcement officers are trained from this old 1960s mentality of how to treat a victim, which is you treat them like they are a suspect. And you do that because the idea is if you can just stay hard on them during that questioning period, if they're lying, then they'll get emotional and the truth will come out. And that's just not an effective method. And we know that now because of decades of research in psychology. And in the UK, they use a different type of methodology of questioning the victims, and they lead to a much more successful rate of finding the truth. They have much fewer wrongful convictions. They have less trauma of their victims that are going in the doors. That's a training issue, and we need the resources. And there's just a general education that needs to happen on both sides to where our justice system can actually be effective, because there are a number of things that went wrong in the very highly publicized Trayvon Martin situation, but very little of it had to do with bad intentions. That maybe was 10% of it. The rest of it was just a system that is quite frankly very broken and needs to be updated and have the proper resources to function properly.
You know, there are so many miscarriages of justice in Florida that it's almost, you could do a month of shows just on that. But, you know, one, I can't help but think when I think in terms of domestic problems here in Florida, the case of the woman in northern Florida who immediately following the Trayvon Martin case and the other one, where she just fired off a warning shot and found herself facing more jail time than people who actually killed human beings. You know, with this stand your ground, if you're looking to improve our justice system, I hope that's another issue that you'll take into consideration. Let me ask you this. You mentioned your book. Why don't you tell our audience where they can go to get it? And again, the name of it.
So it's called A Fearless Voice, and it's based on my story and what happened with the client that I mentioned, but that is really just where the story begins. From there, I talk about how I was immersed into this justice system situation that was very surreal, and I talk about other people that I met along the way, research that I came across as far as why these things happen. It was very important for me to ask the question why, and much like yourself, okay, this is a problem, but what are we going to do to solve it? And so right now people can get it on Amazon, they can get it on Kindle, also on Amazon Global. And I would love it if people would read it and talk about it and offer their own solutions, because what I'm hoping that it is a call to action to say, yes, we have a very broken system, but we can take charge again. We can become inspired. I think it's so difficult to watch the session like we're having in Tallahassee right now, where we just feel like we're getting punched in the face over and over and over again. At some point in time, you just get too tired to even hold your hands up in front of your face. But I am hoping that we can see that no matter what happens, no matter how dark it seems, there are amazing people out there that you're going to meet along the way, that we have amazing people in the progressive community. I happen to believe it's darkest before the dawn, and this is time for us to really rally the troops and make a huge impact starting now and going beyond these next two elections.
Well, thank you so very much, Shauna. We wish you the best of luck and every success in your campaign. And I'd like to invite you now to come on right after you're elected, okay?
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, you take care. Ladies and gentlemen, our next guest has been a progressive leader for many, many years, a man of tremendous political insight, a leader, a political advocate. I'd like to welcome, ladies and gentlemen, Luis Cuevas of Progressive Push. Luis, welcome, sir.
Hey, brother. How are you?
Sir, as always, I'm honored to have you join us. It is our special pleasure to hear you again.
It is my honor to be in with you.
Thank you, brother. So tell me, you're a man of keen political insight. with so many moving targets to pay attention to, what's your short list of issues you're faced with right now, sir?
Oh, wow. That's a loaded question, but essentially, let me ask you, will Bill Nelson run for governor or not?
You know, I think that's an interesting question, and I think, again, making lemonade out of lemons, I think it shows the sting that the corporate Democrats have felt because we're just not rolling over on the crisp. We're just not going to go along, get along. Sorry, Charlie. You know, hiding in a wall, it's not enough. And I think the only reason they're going in this direction, because he'd clearly said before he wasn't interested. But I think the corporate power that be is saying, geez, we got to run with somebody who they're not going to fight us with.
What's, yeah.
Is that your thought, sir? What are your feelings on?
Yeah, right out there. I mean, I think that Bill Nelson runs against himself, for one thing. The other one thing is that when you take on his voting record, it's pretty lousy, frankly. And the other one thing is that he already ran for governor before, and it was nasty. It was a really dirty campaign that he ran. I mean, he was great as insurance commissioner. I think that was Nelson at his best, but that was so very many years ago that he's forgotten. And, you know, it's when he ran for governor that he defined himself. He lost, and, you know, surely within a few years, the Republicans took control of the Florida legislature, and they moved on to the governorship, and ever since then, they've been in control of the state.
You know, it seems to me he's got a very weak case. Because he's basically been able to hide as a senator, and he's voting records all over the map. I know whenever I see him on C-SPAN, he's hanging out with Republicans.
Right.
And, you know, what issue, you know, okay, well, he'll come out and speak a platitude or two about this or a platitude about that, but he votes with Republicans most of the time.
Oh, you bet. Yes. You know, he is a typical Dixiecrat. That's what he's always been. And, you know, when you come to think of it, he's betrayed every single progressive group that's ever come up in Florida to push for any form of legislature. And he's always uses the same excuse. So that is one of both he would never get. Because the progressive vote in Florida is very much against him. He would not be able to put that together.
Where are they going to find differences between him and Scott? I mean, okay, find the ideological place where they differ. They're both Republicans, you know?
Exactly. The thing is that when you think about it, you know, when he ran against Childs, he used the dirtiest campaign, even going to, even though Childs was, you know, he wasn't a, what we would call a progressive today. He was much of a blue dog. At that time, he used very personal attacks in that. And whenever we've followed him in his votes concerning war issues, veterans issues, like you said, he sticks with the Republican vote. So what's the difference, you see? So there's nothing there. And, you know, when we think about it, he's coming up, and like you said, you know, he's coming up with that do I run? Or I think he wants to be asked. He's begging, you know. It's just like, you know, he does protest too much. and when you think about, you know, the question with Charlie Crist, you know, he is being pushed by powers above. He's just been given $500,000 for his campaign. And so, you know, we know that is going to be, you know, he's going to be the candidate unless the massive amounts of people in the Democratic Party rise up and say no. It doesn't look good.
Let me ask you this. I don't know if you've heard, you probably did, but there was recently one of the West Palm Beach Democrats tried to get the West Palm Beach Democratic Party to endorse the idea of a debate.
Mm-hmm.
And, And the powers that be said, well, they couldn't come out in favor of debate because that'd be picking sides. And you know, you got to wonder what part of a debate is supporting the idea of an exchange of ideas in the open marketplace, what part of that's taking sides? So, you know, I was impressed that they couldn't come up with a better excuse than that.
Let me tell you about this thing, about this taking sides, because that's a, I mean, that's a gimmick with the Democratic Party of the state of Florida, that you have all these rules and bylaws and all that, and I've gone over them. And you know, you're supposed, there is a rule that says that there's got to be neutrality when there is going to be more than one Democratic candidate running against each other, right? But then I found out that the person who wrote this and his, well, for lack of another, let's say friends, collaborators in the endeavor of writing the bylaws, they said, but it does not apply to the leadership, because the leadership of the party can actually endorse whom they want, regardless of whom the membership endorses. And that's
how do you
what keeps
have
happening.
A party, how do you have a party where ideas can contend without having some opposition, without leaving room for opposing ideas? What is this? The guidelines for a monarchy? I mean, come on.
Yeah, perfect. I mean, you're right. But that is what has been happening, continues to happen, and it's been for years. I have encountered numerous candidates, progressive candidates, who have gone up against this beast, and this is what happens all the time. And going back to Bill Nelson, he's been the kingmaker in Florida elections for years and years now. And he's the one who chooses who's going to run for this or that. It's like the Pope of Florida Democrats. Everybody goes over and asks him, and progressive need not ask, because they will not be, the request will not be listened to. And I do know a very nice person that ran for Congress who actually chased him up and down the convention center at Disney World and pinned him down. He couldn't find a door to get away from this person because she kept asking him about, pinned down on him on his, position. And he kept saying, oh, we are on the same side. We're on the same side. And finally she said, yeah, but you are returning friendly fire. This is it. You're in the trenches. We're supposed to be in the trenches, but you're firing at us. You're helping the other side. And he just finally find the door that he could sneak in the men's bathroom and get away. But that's him. I mean, and I know that he's, progressives go, and when he goes to local meetings and they try to pin him down, oh, he runs away. For many years, he boasted. Remember Martinez, who was in the Senate? And, they would shop at the same Publix down in Southwest Florida and have the, nice conversations, they said, over there. And said, well, you decide how you vote for me and I'll vote for you and that type of thing. But frankly, that's Florida politics. We're still in the 19th century of how that is being done. And very many nice candidates, good candidates, don't stand a chance because of that type of politics. And here's my question. What who decided that Johnny Crist was going to be it? Well, it doesn't seem like anybody has asked the Florida Democrats about that.
Yes, sir. You know, you got that.
He's been in post. We keep having that. We're told this is going to be your candidate, whether it is, you know, from the patriarchs at the top, or the DSCC or the DCCC, and they choose our candidates. And then you ask the question, why won't people turn out to vote? And, you know, it is frustrating because the people are not up there. It's just, you know, and I'm one who says, you know, you got to go out there. You got to go vote. You got to show up. No, if you don't vote, you're going to be ruled by your inferiors. You're going to be ruled by fools.
Sure.
You know, that's what happens. But then the average person is going to tell you, you know, come back at you and say, yeah, but we have a bunch of fools who are at the top making those decisions. And they just simply cancel our vote. And that's how they feel. You know, and when you see the marginalized millions of voters, then the position is, you know, it doesn't matter why, because I keep being poor. I keep being stepped on. I don't have a chance. You see, they come and go, and I'm still down here. And we have to address that.
You're absolutely right, sir. You know, you can't look somebody serious in the face and say, yes, our voices count, our voices matter, when the party just rolls over them.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this. You're a little closer to Tallahassee than we are. For that, I apologize. if you can look back at the legislative session so far, do you see any victories, whether from an active bill or from a bill that's been thwarted?
I frankly don't, because of the way they do things. You know, every piece of legislation they put through, for one thing, is being imposed on because of the majority that they, Republicans, have in Tallahassee. We got a strong Democrats who try their best out there, but they just can't because, frankly, they don't have strong numbers behind them. The other thing is there is no pushback from the state party. It's always quiet. I mean, it's quick to say, give us money. I mean,
oh, yeah.
I'm getting all these, you and I get all these spam that says, quick, now, emergency, send us money. And then I said, wait, when does it get to the candidate that I want? No, where did that money go to? You know, and where did you go to fight that piece of legislation? Where did you put that ad that says, this is a piece of garbage that we're having, you see? Now, let me put this in perspective. There is a bill now in the Tallahassee that will forbid insurance companies from charging more for people who have multiple guns at home for insurance. So what do we have here is a Affordable Gun Care Act in the state of Florida that says, it doesn't matter how many guns you have. An insurance company cannot say you're a risk for having, an arsenal at home. You know, they have to give you insurance. What happened to the free market right there?
Yeah.
And what about the security of the civilians? So we go the range and we see that it's not for the benefit of the public, but it's always for the benefit of somebody else. And, and Tallahassee is good at that. And they're pushing all these charter, school projects.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? There's not even the demand for them. But they want to allocate the state money for charter schools. So all these bills are being propped up and put up there. And Democrats can't do anything about it because they just don't have the numbers. On the other hand, where are the numbers in terms of money that the state, that the Democratic Party is putting up to prop up their candidates and get them elected? They're not backing them up.
Yeah.
Yeah. And don't get me fired up over the fact that they're not supporting congressional candidates in the state of Florida. And that there are so many House seats for the state of Florida that are not being challenged. So they sit here collecting all this money, and they say, oh, for the House, let that, leave that for the DCCC. And the DCCC says, oh, well, they don't have $100,000 to start with, and we're not going there. So, okay, so we can't win, can we?
I asked one of the leaders of a progressive women's group, and I said, why is it that you're not supporting Nan Rich's candidacy?
Mm.
And she said, well, I'm really glad you asked that, because, and I said, now, I do want to hear your side. I have to tell you in advance, I can't think of a blooming reason in the universe that if you take money to get progressive women candidates giving them some running money, I can't imagine how this works. And I got a song and dance about how, well, funding is limited and they're going to support the legislature rather than the governor's race. And I said, I'll be frank with you. A progressive is running. It is such a rare thing in a major race against a wallet. The guy's a wallet. He has no issues. He has no ideas. He has no agenda other than, let me get elected. I'm Chucky. You can't find money to give to an honest, breathing woman who's had real leadership experience. I don't understand.
Right. It's extremely, it's pathetic, to put it mildly. They just
You're
won't.
Being generous.
I'm trying not to use expletives. But you know what? We all know, I think it's been proven time and time again, when progressives run, they are allowed to run, and they run on their, on their strength, and they say to people, listen, you won't agree with me, I won't agree with you, I will listen to you, though, as opposed to the other guy, And that was Wellstone's recipe for success. Wellstone won in Republican territory. And bless his heart, he battled against the toughest people, and he managed to get in there in the U.S. Senate. And that was a great loss when his plane crashed. And unfortunately, it turned the U.S. Senate over to the Republicans. And I won't go beyond that now because it gets me infuriated. But anyway, when you think about it, progressives stand a chance. Right now, there are progressives more than ever running throughout the United States. And they're running on their own. And they're running on their own strength. and they're running on their energy of their hearts and the people who follow them, and they're trying to get in. There is no support from above because they don't want it. There are powers that be that want to stop that from happening. It troubles me that we got some people in Florida that ran last time on a progressive ticket. You know, they pushed themselves as progressive. They got elected, and there's a candidate near you who did that.
Yeah.
And then he turned around, and he's been voting with
political. Now he's bipartisan, which means screw your agenda. The hell with the Democratic agenda. I'm going to make deals because that makes me popular.
Yes. And you know what? There is a group that we're allies with, Progressive Punch, that they put out a listing in terms of the voting. And you have this candidate, this incumbent in the state of Florida, who is in the bottom five. And you know what they call themselves now? They used to call themselves Blue Dogs.
Yeah.
But they were walloped in the last election, right? So
yeah.
now they call themselves New Democrats.
Yeah.
Yeah, the New Democrats. But what are they? They're just
the Republican left.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and they come in and they go, they vote with the Republicans. I don't know how many of them, 39 last time, voted against Obamacare, just for the sake of it, and now they just want to be reelected. There is a person from Arizona who was trained by the most progressive groups in the United States. She had the backing of all these people, and I'll tell him, Kristen Sinema from Arizona. She made it to the Senate in Arizona, and then she began to show her true colors.
Yeah.
As soon as she got there, she began to side with the president of the Arizona Senate. And, she began to vote her way. Oh, but he's my boss. I can't go against him. Wait a minute. You were not elected by the Republicans, you see. Then she runs for the U.S. House. And ever since then, as soon as she came in, she's been voting Republican, as she is in the bottom three of votes in the U.S. Congress for anything anywhere near Democratic or progressive.
Luis, if you can stick around, I would love to have you stick around, buddy. Because I've got to bring my next guest. Can you say? Oh, that's great.
All right. We'll do.
Okay, next we've got Steve Horn, wonderful progressive blogger, activist journalist. Stephen, welcome. Stephen, are you there?
I hope you're talking to me, but it's Anthony. How are you, Rick?
Oh, it's Anthony. I'm sorry, sir. I'm sorry. Welcome, sir. Welcome. How are you today?
I'm doing just fine. How are you? I understand completely about getting the roster a little out of order. That's why I have never managed a baseball team.
This is Anthony Knoll of New Progressive Alliance, and he's communications director. Anthony, tell us, sir, what's new with you up there on the East Coast?
Well, I've been listening for the last few minutes here. I just called in and I was able to catch some of what Luis was saying. And I'm glad he's hanging around. I don't know if you can conference this together, but if
I'd love to. Yeah.
Great. How are you, Luis?
Good. How are you?
Oh, I'm conscious and alert. It's the end of a long weekend.
Great.
But hey, listen. I completely understand everything that you're saying regarding false progressives. It's one of the reasons the NPA exists, is to try to call these folks out and do it as early as possible. We would love to ally with you, you know, do whatever we can to help your cause along.
Rock on.
Well, you know, the important thing, I think, is that we need to identify candidates right out of the chute who are willing to sign on to truly progressive principles. And that is what the NPA is all about.
Mm-hmm.
If you had had, I don't know if you've been to our website, but I'd love for you to drop by. And, of course, anyone else listening, newprogs.org. And what we did, we're a crowdsourced organization which was founded 4 years ago after Obama folded on a public option. And I worked extremely hard to get this charlatan elected back in 08, and it was quite frustrating, to say the least, the direction that he has taken. It's George Bush on steroids, as far as I'm concerned, George W. But we put together, we were totally crowdsourced on Fire Dog Lake, and essentially the upshot is we have a 10-point platform which identifies progressive principles, which also were voted on by the crowd. And we support candidates who support those principles because, as Noam Chomsky has said, we've got the tail on the wrong end of the dog in this country.
Mm-hmm.
We find candidates who are telegenic or who say the things that we want to hear, but we don't hold their feet to the fire. So we decided that we've got to start putting issues first. And just this year in this midterm election, we are getting the support for the platform from Cindy Sheehan, California governor, Paul Glover, Pennsylvania governor, Howie Hawkins from New York governor, all of them, well, actually Paul and Howie running on the green ticket. Of course, Cindy's on the Peace and Freedom Party ticket. But my personal favorite is a guy by the name of Kenneth Kendrick, and I don't know if you're aware of who that is, but pretty interesting story. You may recall the Peanut Corporation of America back in late 2008, early 2009. Nine people died and 700 were sickened by salmonella from peanut butter products.
Yeah.
And Kenneth, at the time, was working for Peanut Corporation of America as an assistant manager in their plant. In Texas, an assistant plant manager, he warned his higher-ups. He blew the whistle on unsanitary conditions. They ignored him, and that's what happened. And Kenneth is running for Texas Agriculture Commissioner. These are the types of people who are starting to come out, who are sick and tired of candidates who say one thing, do something differently, and as you alluded to in the case of Arizona, go along to get along.
Mm-hmm.
And I would love to hear your thoughts.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Yeah. I follow you. I think that there is a distinct situation here in which finally progressives are coming on their own strongly. I think that many are beginning to feel that what we call it the wine effect, that speaking your mind and coming through, is really a strong motivator. And I have been working with several groups, including Blue America, Howie Klein with Down with Tyranny, and they look for these candidates who actually are out to put the word out there that this is the way it ought to be. This is not just the way it ought to be. This is the way it should be. This is the way it can be. And this is how we can do it. And they are getting support. So why can't we, push more of that? And I think that the more we coalesce, we act in fusion, and we push these candidates and we put them out there, the more success we'll have.
I think in a way they're going to play into our hands.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think that in a way they're playing right into our hands, because it looks like they want to anoint Hillary, that corporate shill, as the next have-to-be-elected Democrat. And I think there are so many progressives out there that are fed up with that Clintonista crap.
Bet.
And I think it's going to make it easier for us to run a significant challenger to her.
Well, and I have to just chime in here if I could and say that I think that, anybody who seriously believes that anyone other than Hillary is going to get the Democratic Party nomination, I think is deluding themselves. It's the deal she made in order for Obama to get nominated first. This is the second half of that deal, and it's who the Democrats are going to nominate this year. I finished a very interesting book, and I'm not sure whether you, Luis, or Rick are familiar with it. I'm a huge fan of Hunter S. Thompson, who wrote just incredibly seminal work on covering political races in a book called Fear and Loathing on the Campaign Trail, 72. Mm-hmm. Now, I've been a lifelong journalist. This book is a hallmark if you go to J school, it's something that you have to read. Mm. And I never did because I, like many others, was enamored of the Thompson who wrote Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, which was much more notable in many ways. But the amazing thing about Campaign Trail 72 is it shows how the Democratic Party since then, and even before, but particularly in that year when George McGovern tried to take over the party, and, that's the argument that a lot of progressives or people who at least, want to be thought of as progressives use is that, well, we have to take over the Democratic Party from the inside because it has all of the, ballot access. It has all these things in place. Well, McGovern tried it in and he was railroaded by his fellow Democrats, by the old guard of the Democratic Party, in depicting Thomas Eagleton as vice president. And for those who don't remember,
imploded on schedule.
I'm sorry?
I said who imploded on schedule.
Exactly. Yeah. But, I never, and as someone who lived through that period, I felt that I knew what had happened. But I was wrong. Once I read Thompson's book, I understood that, as much as they tried to make out McGovern as the criminal for failing with that kind of a choice, he was, when you read Thompson's behind-the-scenes accounts, and Thompson is a first-rate journalist, even though he built a reputation for altering substances and their abuse, he, in terms of his journalistic prowess, is first rate, and anyone who has read this book or any of his works will tell you that. He documents in very clear detail exactly how the old guard of the party maintained control of the party, and I'm going to tell you guys exactly what the Clinton wing is going to do again this year. And the Democratic Party has gotten so good at it that truly grassroots voices like Cindy Sheehan, like Paul Glover, like, the former employee of a major corporation who blew the whistle on that corporation and is now trying to turn that activism into a post where he can make a real difference in saving lives. The Democratic Party is going to do whatever it has to do to silence these people in every race, and they're going to do the same thing to Elizabeth Warren. They already did when Obama denied her the chairmanship of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And, convinced her to run for senator instead. She created that organization. She's the one that should be running it. And the fact that she is not was a huge compromise to the Republicans.
Just one more betrayal.
Yep.
But, when you've been inside the beast, I think most of us know that you realize how the system actually is meant to create an aura of how things, the desirable outcomes, but in fact they are not. It's just like we really don't get too serious on us, because that's not the way it works. And this is how we do it. And you either are with us or you have to get out.
Exactly.
Or if not, they put so much pressure on you that you cannot stand it and you just bail out.
Exactly. And
that is why you have all these NPA, the rising political movement in the United States is the no party affiliation, a.k.a. independence. But essentially they are not. You know, when you think about it, there are people there who are independents and they will either vote Republican and they would vote Democrat, or they would, you know, then 10% of it will be truly independent. But it's because there is a block of what we call pissed off Democrats. You see, in there, these are people who are so turned off that have gone out. And when they vote Democrat, they vote for candidates of their own. You know, that is what is happening there. But they have so very few choices. And, you know, case in point, did you see how Kentucky's Democratic candidate for the Senate turns around now and says that she backs the Keystone Pipeline?
Yes.
And right now, I mean, you say all these people who were pushing suddenly say, wait a minute, what is this? But, you know, then they tell you, oh, you know, too late, either me or you're going to go for McConnell. See, and that's a trap.
It is a trap, and that's exactly what we call it. It's the two-party trap, and people who want to vote independent are called spoilers. They're accused of, you know, you're gonna split this vote. When the only way that we're going to break out of this two-party trap is to stop supporting it. The only way that we have to support it or deny it is that vote. We can't afford to buy it like the corporations already have.
Yeah.
And they own it.
Yeah.
You know, a very famous, and you mentioned how the Blue Dogs are trying to change their image now by calling themselves New Democrats. Well, as you may know, Luis, in Canada, the NDP, the New Democratic Party, is quite different from that. It's much farther to the left, and it booted out that country's equivalent of our Democratic Party, the Liberals. It's now the chief opposition party in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And the New Democrats were founded by Tommy Douglas, who was not even Canadian born. He brought nationalized health care to Canada. And, you know, it's taken them 50 years to build that party. And I got in a pretty interesting argument once on the PDA website. It's the only one, to my knowledge, that has been removed, this little discussion that I had on their blog. But it was also the most watched while the blog still existed, challenging that whole notion of, well, how, you know, at what point did the NDP stop becoming a spoiler and start becoming what we'd consider a legitimate party? Well, the answer is you're a legitimate party as soon as you're founded. It's just a question of whether the people are going to stand up and vote for you. And eventually, if you persist, they will. But it takes generations. It's not a one cycle or a two cycle
That's
thing.
Right.
It's a generational thing. You've got to build it. Yeah. You've got to be patient. And the first thing you have to do is recognize that you're probably not going to see the change in your lifetime, but your kids might, and their grandkids will, if you can keep going.
But that's where we've been banging on the, you know, on every wall that we can, and telling people, you know, local elections matter. That is when we can do the effective change. You see, go for the school board. Go for every advisory board in the county, in the city. Go for the city commission, the county commission. Get on board. Control those. You see, that's the power basis of everything else.
Exactly right.
You know, people don't realize that's what the Republicans did, you know, 30 years ago. They set out to undermine the system, and they went after every single local position available. And
that's
sure enough, they just, you know, crippled the Democrats, where all these representatives used to have a power basis. It collapsed because there was nothing below them. They have taken them away from them.
Exactly right, Luis. And you know, hand in hand with that, I would just add, and I know that you've been in rooms like this, I sure have, where if you even suggest that independents need to take a page, particularly, you know, lefty independents, need to take a page from the Republican playbook, it will be met with umbrage purely because you said the word Republican.
Yeah. Yeah.
Never mind that it worked and that it's still working and that it's burying us. Why would we want to copy that? It's a Republican idea. People, grow up.
I was shouted down one time at a Democratic meeting here in my county when I suggested that since they hadn't even run a Democrat in 10 years, that we actually start hosting our own debates with Republicans. And they said, oh, no, it's in our charter. We're not allowed to have debates. I said, you're not allowed to have debates? What kind of sense is that? Don't you want to get the people involved, get them engaged, show the marketplace of ideas? He said, oh, no, we can't do that at all.
Yeah, it's so frustrating.
And the problem is that it turns people off, and they don't see, just because it doesn't get out there, they don't see that there are alternatives. And, you know, I think that the true alternatives are in the independent vote. Whether you want to call yourself a family and labor party or the Green Party or the Independent Party, but, you know, there are all these groups out there who are working at the very basics. And in New York, for example, you have seen how the Family and Workers Party has been able to create a power basis. And
yeah,
in fact,
so
they were very much behind de Blasio when he won.
Yes, the Working Families Party. That's true.
Yeah.
That's true. Yeah. And there are even more progressive examples of those kinds of successes. But as you say, Luis, it's at the local level. And the other thing that is too often ignored is U.S. House. Because, you know, the first thing, and we've been conditioned to think this way in America, it's about the presidency. No, it's not.
Yeah, exactly.
You can elect an independent president anytime you want. If there's nobody in the House and Senate to support him, it's meaningless.
Yep.
It is absolutely meaningless. So where you have to start, what we really need to start doing if we're serious about building a progressive, an alternate or many alternate parties, or not even parties, right? You know, we're trying to get to a postpartisan, as you said, no political affiliation state, because what matters is policy. Once we start voting policy over party, that's when we'll start to see those changes. And every 2 years we have a chance to completely flip the U.S. House of Representatives, and too few people run. And it's cheap to do. It's easy to do comparatively.
Gentlemen,
certainly than a Senate or a presidential campaign. I'm sorry, Rick, go ahead.
That's okay. Let me pause this conversation because I need to bring on my last guest. And you're both welcome to stick around if you like. I'd be glad to have you, but I'm going to now welcome on Mr. Steve Horn.
Great.
Steve, welcome.
Good to be back. Thanks for having me.
Well, Steve, I know you want to talk about we've got Tony Noel from NPA. And we've got Luis Cuevas on from A Progressive Push. Steve, you've got a story you've just been covering on the peace expansion in Ukraine. Why don't you talk to us about the Biden initiative and the CIA? Well, let's not call it the CIA initiative. That's something we don't talk about. But go ahead, Steve. Tell us about Ukraine.
Yeah, well, in Ukraine this past week, Joe Biden took a trip to Monday and Tuesday, and among other things, after the trip, the White House put out a policy memo, basically, about what they're going to do to help support Ukraine through the crisis that's going on in East Ukraine and in Crimea, and I guess in the country at large. And part of it, unfortunately, for those who care about a sustainable planet, is that President Biden is going to continue what the White House has been doing. I guess it's not really a surprise, as I said in my article, but helping with basically technical support for promotion of hydraulic fracturing or fracking in the country, since the United States was the kind of the global innovator on that technology. It's now gone ahead under the auspices of the State Department's Global Shale Gas Initiative, or it's now been repackaged as the Unconventional Gas Technical Engagement Program. basically going to go ahead in Ukraine and continue with that. I kind of pointed out in my article how it gets complicated. I said this is this is being done under the auspices of Russia dominating that region's gas market and Putin using gas as a weapon. Unfortunately, I guess to debunk that narrative, the United States biggest oil and gas companies have very close ties with Rosneft, the Russian state oil and gas company, including ExxonMobil, BP, Shell, et cetera, all have extensive ties with Rosneft around the world, including in the United States, in Alaska, offshore in the Gulf of Mexico, in Texas, where there's fracking happening. And I pointed out in my article that on top of that, actually, Exxon is helping Russia tap into its shale gas bounty in the Bezanov shale, which is in Siberia, and that's said to be 80 times the size of the Bakken shale, which is the biggest shale basin where fracking happens in the United States and North Dakota. So although it's being done under the Joe Biden's initiative, the White House initiative to fend off the region from Russian gas, at the same time, the biggest U.S. oil and gas companies are working directly with Russia to produce oil and gas around the world. So I think at the end of the day, it really shows that these oil and gas companies have tight ties, and it's kind of a smokescreen for them to continue to be able to produce profits at record levels while the planet roasts. And so that's what I saw as the basis of that trip, more or less.
Do you think with the increase of military exercises with related countries over there, do you think they're really trying to escalate tensions with Russia?
I think that it's complicated. I think that Russia has its own interests, based on the fact that it's being encircled right now by NATO. It does see that as a threat. At the same time, there's this possibility of something blowing up militarily, and we are seeing that. But at the same time, where it gets complicated is the fact that, like I said, there's really tight business ties at in the energy sector between Russia and the United States. So when you look at the sanctions and who they've been issued to, you don't really see them being issued to anyone in Rosneft, because if that happened, then it would actually hurt U.S. oil and gas companies. So it's a tricky situation there, and I think that the main people who suffer because of it, this geopolitical battle royale, are the people of Ukraine who really had nothing to do with this crisis starting, who just happened to live there. So that's this imperial standoff between these two powers. The loser of it, as always, are the majority of the people.
I think it's kind of interesting that a month or so ago, that Russia released on the internet this taped conversation between Ms. Nuland and the ambassador to Ukraine, that they are basically cooking the books to get this these radical fascists installed, and at the same time there's just huge umbrage about the Russians claiming some areas over there. If both sides are manipulating the playing field, where is right and wrong engaged? It seems to be, completely inapplicable. And then also, we've got a situation where with Iraq falling apart, they're actually announcing that they're sending intelligence officers. We're almost in Never Never Land in terms of U.S. foreign policy.
Yeah, and, you know, I think, again, I want to emphasize that number one goal of these foreign policy operations, you know, if it's Iraq, if it's Ukraine or elsewhere, is I mean, number one, national security policy in the United States revolves around secure flow of oil and gas and other fuels for the Western powers that was established by the Carter Doctrine, President Carter, way back decades ago in the State of the Union, said that that's a central prong of U.S. national security policy. So that's sort of why, if you look at Iraq or Russia, there's instability. The goal would always be stability so that the oil and gas can flow, and that's what they mean by national security, is the secure flow of oil and gas and other commodities. But it all revolves around, you know, what these big corporations want for the profits. So, that, I mean, I would say that that's not a really popular way of looking at foreign policy, but that I mean, that's straight from the books of, if you look at, you know, foreign policy memos, if you look at the State Department diplomatic cables from WikiLeaks, if you look at all that, that's what the United States government says, and that's what happens behind the scenes. So I don't think that, you know, what's happening in Iraq or Russia, it's any different than maybe what's happening in Latin America or elsewhere. The central theme is the open door, as historian William Appleman Williams wrote about in lots of his books. He was a University of Wisconsin historian. I recommend that your listeners read his books.
Steve, let me ask you another question. I know you've been very closely following the XL pipeline issue, and it, like the TPP, has been buried several times. It was a pseudo-leaked announcement that he was going to definitely shut it down. What are you hearing between the lines on the XL pipeline?
Yeah, well, you know, the Keystone XL pipeline, there's a recent article, I think you were referring to the Rolling Stone article, in which a couple of people inside the White House or close to the White House told Jeff Goodell, who's a reporter there, that it looks like the thing is going to be canned after the 2014 elections, and for now he just kicked it down the road because he didn't want to hurt the Democrats' chance at potentially winning seats either way. People who are in states where it's unpopular to be environmentalist, such as in Louisiana, and then places, you know, kind of both ways, to lose to say anything in 2014. So according to that article, it's going to, you know, it's going to be a no decision after the election. My whole take on it, as I've said multiple times on this show, is while we're talking a lot about the Keystone XL, first of all, the southern half is open for business as of January 2014. Second of all, an article I just wrote and many articles I read is there's all these other incredible pipelines being built to carry things such as gas to be exported from fracking, or lots of tar sands pipelines being built in the Midwest and going eastward and westward to various markets. So I think the problem is that the more we focus on kind of, I wouldn't really call it a spectacle, it is important, so it's not a spectacle, but the more we focus on just the Keystone XL, which does have its own footprint, the more we ignore all these other pipelines that have an enormous footprint combined that, you know, become bigger than the Keystone XL alone. So I always encourage people to look at the big picture and kind of try to follow what the business press is talking about, because the business press is geared towards people who are looking to make money off of these pipelines. So they write about lots of pipelines. The environmentalists kind of have only honed in on the Keystone XL, and I think that that's unfortunate because of all these other pipelines that will have both an ecological and climate change footprint down the road, big time.
Steve, let me. I've got also Luis Cuevas with us and Tony Noel. Gentlemen, I'm going to ask that let the floor be open. If Luis, if you have a question you'd like to ask Steve.
Right now, you know, I'm looking at the situation there with the Russians and the U.S. and how much of this is really the, you know, European banksterism, if you will. You know, all this austerity that has been pushed throughout Europe, and they've been pushing further and further out in what used to be part of the Soviet Union, and you know, they have, if you look at the map, they have actually taken what the Russians used to think of as the buffer zone away, and how much of this is a reaction to that on what is happening right now with the Ukraine, and happened before in Georgia, and will continue to happen.
Well, right, and that gets to, I mean, there's two things that you kind of unpack there. There's the issue of NATO encirclement of Russia. NATO is kind of seen by, if people even know what NATO is, it's sort of seen as just this, it's seen as an alliance between the Atlantic countries, which is basically the EU countries, and the United States. Actually, it's been growing in recent years, and that's a central central piece of this whole controversy in the Ukraine. Russia has become increasingly encircled by NATO over time. Russia has been building up its own sort of security organization with allies, and so we're really seeing new blocks of power forming in the region. And so I think that Russia does see this as a threat for its own national security, just as the United States would see it if a bunch of countries went around the United States with with military exercises and was doing what the United States is doing. So that's number one. Number two, the austerity and the banksters, as you refer to them as. I think that, although I'm not qualified to really speak to that, I do recommend that listeners check out anything that economist Michael Hudson is saying about that. He's often on the Real News Network, and he's been all over that, and global austerity and also austerity here at home in the United States. If you're interested in that, Michael Hudson is top notch for that analysis. And I want to put in a plug. I'm actually. Oh, go ahead.
I was just
I know we're kind of tight on time here, but Steve, just real quickly. I'm curious, you mentioned the construction of East and West heading pipelines versus the KXL. Of course, some already exist in the form of railroad cars in no small amounts. I think that's I'd like to hear you talk a little bit about that, where even if the KXL is not approved for a north-south route, Do you think that rail will handle what they want to be headed that way anyway, number one? And number two, if we have the time, John Perkins, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, you're probably familiar with it, tells a story of how the U.S. sold infrastructure to make companies beholden to us. And, of course, it seems to me that energy has just replaced that because it's such a global need. And I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Sure. Well, number one, I don't think that rail could ever replace pipelines. I think that that's a false debate that a lot of people who only talk about Keystone XL kind of fall back on. They say, well, rail can't replace it, so it's got to be the Keystone XL. What I say is it's not about rail versus Keystone XL. It's actually about Keystone XL versus many other pipelines. And that's why I say east, west, north, south. There's all those alternatives that exist. So it's pipelines that go in all those directions that aren't Keystone XL. And the whole idea of this technology transfer and sort of teaching best practices for these technologies, once you kind of own the technology and have the patent over it, that's kind of what the TPP is all about, and that's what the World Bank is all about, is kind of using these tools as a way, as a power leverage over other countries that need them, but have to become dependent on the United States or the Western countries for them. So,
it has very little to do with national borders, doesn't it?
No, very little. Although it's important still for securing money and finance and stuff. But at the end of the day, it's global capital, global multinational corporations.
Well, gentlemen, I want to thank you all. It's been wonderful talking to you, Luis Cuevas, Tony Noel, and Steve Horn. Thanks so much. I wish we could do another 2 hours. Gentlemen, have a very good night, and we'll talk to you
soon.
Thank
you, too. Good night.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks for all your good thinking. Bye-bye. Ladies and gentlemen, I want to remind you, there are other good progressive broadcasters in the area, Gwen Holden Berry and her show Here Be Monsters, Brian Stett and his show Progress Toward Democracy, Anita Stewart and her show Wise Woman Media, Susan Nylon, The Nylon Report, Sita Baguil, Sita Media, and Harriet Lerman, The Voice of the People. This is Rick Spezak, News Director of Progressive News Network. Thanks so much. Tune in next week. Bye-bye. And how about some music on the way out?
It was in the town of Shawnee a Saturday afternoon. His wife beside him in his wagon as into town they rode. There a deputy sheriff approached him in a manner rather rude. Vulgar words of anger and his wife she overheard. Pretty boy grabbed a log chain and the deputy grabbed his gun. In the fight that followed he laid that deputy down. Then he took to the trees and timber to live a life of shame. Every crime in Oklahoma was added to his name. But a many a starving farmer the same old story told. How the outlaw paid their mortgage and saved their little homes. Others tell you about a stranger that come to beg a meal. Underneath his napkin left a $1,000 bill. It was in Oklahoma City. It was on a Christmas day. There was a whole carload of groceries come with a note to say. Well, you say that I'm an outlaw, you say that I'm a thief. Here's a Christmas dinner for the families on relief. Guess it's through this world I've wandered. I've seen lots of funny men. Some will rob you with a six gun and some with a fountain pen. And as through your life you travel, yes, as through your life you roam, you won't never see an outlaw drive a family from their home.
Good night.